Now, we have seen the development of the 17th century then, the age of absolutism. We've seen the English Revolution, and as we now cross over or have crossed over to the 18th century, we have several developments which are going to be of great importance. First of all, the rise of two major powers in Europe, Prussia and Russia. Secondly, the acceleration of new ideas about man and his universe, what we call the Enlightenment. And thirdly, at the end of the century, the disintegration of absolutism of the dynastic age in the French and American revolutions. We have started already before Christmas, but to not a very great audience, about the rise of Russia. You haven't missed much. It's not a very good lecture. I don't know much about that. The rise of Russia. That's why I reversed orders, and we're dealing with the rise of Prussia today, because I thought most of you would be back for that event. So that we must today then start with the rise of Prussia, the other great nation, which will have a vital effect on European politics from the 18th century on. And here I am greatly handicapped by the lack of a map. Now already by 1648, by the Peace of Westphalia, there were stirrings in the north. There the family of the Hohenzollern ruled three territories, divided territories, not contiguous, but divided. One, the territory of East Prussia. Secondly, the territory of Brandenburg, with Berlin at the center. And thirdly, territory on the Rhine. Now, this geographical fact will play a major role in the history of Prussia. Why? In three ways. There were no natural frontiers. You couldn't say, as Richelieu said, the frontiers of France are the Rhine and the Alps and the Pyrenees, because there were no natural frontiers. These scattered territories, Brandenburg, East Prussia, and the territory on the Rhine, were set in the great North European plain, the plain which, let me remind you, stretches from the Caucasus to the North Sea, where there are no natural frontiers. Therefore, to maintain itself, the state will have to take on a military character. Secondly, it grew up in the east. The real weight of Prussia was on the eastern territories, Brandenburg and East Prussia. It was therefore, in a sense, a frontier state against Eastern Europe, and its expansionist ambitions will be directed eastwards and above all against Poland. Poland, which was the barrier to eastward expansion for Brandenburg and for East Prussia. Thirdly, apart from the Rhine territories, apart from those, none of these territories had natural resources. Neither minerals nor agriculture. Barren territories, which grow only the pine tree. And therefore, from the beginning, Prussia will have to get a national economic policy to overcome the handicap of the utter lack of natural resources, above all, the attraction and building of a virile middle class. These factors will shape the history of Prussia. They shape the policy of the three rulers, whom we can call the three makers of modern Prussia. The first of these is the great Elector, who ruled from 1640 to 1688. The great Elector, it was he who had taken advantage of the 30 Years' War to bring Prussia into prominence. It is he who had allied with France, which was the correct side to ally with at the end of the 30 Years' War. But already in the time of the great elector, the main lines of Prussian policy are visible. First of all, the emphasis on military strength in that geographical situation. As the great elector put it, alliances are good, but a force of one's own which to rely on is better. He drew the lesson which Thomas Hobbes had perceived so well, that it is only the power of the sword which counted. The building of a military force, however, must be, he believed, accompanied by centralization at home. And thus, almost in one swoop, he lifted Prussia into the age of dynastic absolutism. The local estates of Brandenburg and East Prussia were destroyed. An efficient civil service was founded. All of these things you have already in the reign of the great elector. But the man who was really going to rationalize this kind of approach in this barren and scattered territory was Frederick William I. Frederick William I, who would rule from 1713 to 1740. Frederick William I from 1713 to 1740 is the archetype of what became known in the world as Prussianism. He made his capital not in Berlin, but in the garrison town of Potsdam, which will remain the capital of the kings of Prussia. For Potsdam was a garrison town, the headquarters of the army, in opposition to Berlin, and it was to symbolize this connection. He was concerned during his long reign, above all, with two matters: the founding of a sound economy, as he believed a sound economy to be, and the strengthening of the army. But how did he found a sound economy where there was nothing except the barren soil? First of all, by welcoming new industries. And here he had a windfall. The end of the Edict of Nantes and the flight of many of the most industrious Huguenots, bringing with them whole industries, such as the silk industries. These Huguenots were welcomed in Prussia and have remained ever since. That is why so many Prussian generals have French names, as the present commander-in-chief of the German army, General de la Mazière. They have French names because the Huguenots were welcomed. But indeed, he granted in practice toleration to everyone who could provide a stepped-up economic benefits. And once again in Prussia, toleration comes as a practical thing to build up a barren state, to attract a viable middle class. Thus he tolerated the Jews, for example, and tried to attract them as well. Toleration, not as an ideal, but on a practical economic basis, and indeed on a lasting one. Side by side with this toleration, he extended the established church and tried to do, with greater success, what Queen Elizabeth had done a century before, to make the state church so broad as to be attractive. And that meant, in his case, to make a combination between Lutheranism and Calvinism, what we call nowadays the Church of Prussian Union, between Lutheranism and Calvinism. But while in England, typically enough, the state church meant tolerance, and you get the growth of dissent, as I have told you before, no dissent as such ever developed in Prussia. To be sure, Catholics existed, Jews existed, but what did not exist were Protestant sects. No more than 3% of the Prussian population were outside the great Protestant state church or the Catholic church. Now, why am I making such a point of it? Because obviously there will be a straight relationship between the development of liberal democracy and the existence of Protestant nonconformist sects, especially in England, where the dissenters, the nonconformist Protestants, were the great driving force, in a way, for a pluralist society. But so successful was the state church of the Prussian Union, with its mixture of Calvinism and Lutheranism, that no sectarianism ever grew up in a meaningful way in Prussia. This will be felt in the later Prussian history. At the same time, Frederick William I tried to enforce a strict economy, austerity, primitive. Yes, the whole thing was primitive. His idea of a strict economy was to prevent loitering, and the king himself went around Berlin and saw that nobody loitered. And if he found somebody loitering, he beat him over the head with his stick. It was still rather primitive. The whole thing was primitive, for he had his castle near Potsdam, where he had his famous drinking bouts, and the only one who could be a member of his ministry was whom the king could not drink under the table. It was all, in a way, primitive. I was born a stone's throw from that castle in the center of the Prussian tradition, the real Prussian tradition, to which I shall come in a minute. The emphasis was, however, this, which is good. The emphasis was, however, this, and that is important for the future. Discipline is a national duty. It is this kind of, if you like, primitive, personal, dynastic view of discipline which got him in conflict with his son, the later Frederick the Great, who played the flute, who rebelled, as you will see from your source book. But this rigid disciplinarian was bound to be effective also in army matters, and above all, in the one reform which will distinguish Prussia from all other European countries, namely the integration of the nobility with the army. For unlike the rest of the West, where ever since Louis XIV, professional officers were the officers of the army, in Prussia, poor, barren, the nobility was used to become officers of the army. Gradually, the Prussian nobility, which is known under the name of Junkers, the Prussian nobility, replaced commoners as army officers. The Junkers were poor. The farming was bad in East Prussia, where they had their estate. For their younger sons, the army and army service was the only way out. It is by army service that they were compensated for the privileges the great elector had taken from them. This combination proved to be highly effective. It meant a certain cohesion of this nobility when the other nobilities have lost their cohesion. It meant a loyalty to the House of Hohenzollern, which you do not find, of course, in the nobility of the rest of Europe, which had the tensions we have discussed so much. There was no opposition here between kings and nobles. And it meant that the army could be used effectively to put down local parliaments, local estates, any semblance of local privileges. To affirm it still more, officer schools or cadet schools were founded. And to these officer schools, only the nobility was admitted. So that officer and noble became a caste. A caste through the cadet schools into which only nobles were admitted. The nobility was tied to the monarchy and got the monopoly of a high army position. You might say, therefore, that from the time of Frederick William I, noble power took on a different form in Prussia. It involved the army, and through the army then also in administration. It was just the kind of political participation from which Louis XIV had excluded his nobility, had excluded them because he didn't trust them. The Hohenzollern co-opted them and did not exclude them. They didn't have the history of France, after all. This has been called, rightly, a revolution from above in the structure of the state. It was not the last revolution from above which the Prussian monarchy was to carry through. What this revolution did is that it strengthened and firmed class divisions and preserved them with the greatest of success, prevented a dissatisfied nobility by giving the nobility a central place in the state and in the support of the monarchy. This gave to the nobility a sense of duty which the nobles in the West lacked, for they had a task. You can perhaps put it this way. They commanded their peasants on their large East Prussian estates, and they commanded these peasants again as soldiers in war. Here was the kind of total integration which the Prussian monarchs had desired. The Junkers are a new type of nobility, a nobility of service. And to make this clear, from the time of the king, from the time of Frederick William I on, the king always wore a uniform. And indeed, as you know, the Junkers will dominate the German army until 1945. They don't dominate it anymore. It's become a middle-class officer corps. But they dominated it until 1945. Did that mean militarism? It meant militarism in this sense, that the very geographical situation of Prussia meant, in fact, that military consideration were to be more important than political, merely and purely political ones. The very geographical situation will make this essential. But now it was a state geared to this kind of military action. Frederick William I had a rigid idea of classes and their service to the state. The peasants served on the field and in the army. The nobility commanded the army and the peasant on the field. And the middle class, exempted from military service, provided the money. Here we have, for the first time, a political unit in which everything is slanted to service and duty to the state. Only in this way could the scattered and almost indefensible units survive. The House of Hohenzollern had learned the lessons of the past. Military and economic strength combined made a great power. Geography made it necessary to construct the first rationally set up state in modern Europe. From now on, Prussianism becomes a concept for the rest of Europe. It meant, briefly, for contemporaries and thereafter, first of all, the integration of every group with service to the state. Secondly, that even the king saw himself as first servant of the state, and he too had his duty. How successful was it? You can see this answered in the reign of Frederick the Great, 1740. To 1786. For Frederick the Great, 1740 to 1786, put all this to use. He did not change it. He thought he was an enlightened monarch. He had Voltaire at his court. He wrote in French. He spoke French. Frederick the Great did not speak German, and he could help it. He spoke French. He was influenced by the Enlightenment, and yet he never gave an inch on Prussianism. He kept the division of the state. He emphasized the simplicity of the monarchy, that the monarch was the first servant of the state. He built a castle, and he gave it a French name, Sans Souci, without sorrows. But what a castle! One floor only, few rooms, a direct contrast to Versailles of simplicity, of almost, you might say, ostentatious simplicity. He put it to use in the Seven Years' War. But here again, as you read about the Seven Years' War, the legend will be more important than the reality. What's the reality? He fought against all of Europe. None of Europe had an interest in seeing a strong Prussia. He fought as what he called so nicely the three petticoats. That is to say, Madame Pompadour, then the reigning mistress of Louis XV, Queen Elizabeth of Russia, and Marie Theresa of Austria. But he nearly lost. And what saved him was the death of Elizabeth of Russia, the accession of Peter, as I told you last time, who lived only long enough to make a separate peace with Frederick before he was poisoned by his wife Catherine. And though Catherine might have made a separate peace, we do not know. Peter, however, did. This is the fact. He was nearly beaten. And if there had been no separate peace, he would have beaten. But as he was not beaten, the legend grew up that this Prussian system had successfully fought against all of Europe, against Russia, against France, against Austria. That is the legend. And it is a strong, strong legend. In this sense, Frederick the Great made one of the most important contributions to the work of his father. Not so much in reality, but rather in the founding of the legend of victory, victory achieved himself, Prussia against Europe. When in 1945 Hitler was in the bunker underneath the Reich Chancellery and his empire had crumbled and the Russians were already in the outskirts of Berlin, somebody came in and said to Hitler, Roosevelt had died, and Hitler's reaction was just like that. The Tsarina is dead, because he thought Roosevelt's death would save him, as indeed Elizabeth's death had saved Frederick the Great. So immediate was his contribution. So immediate was this kind of legend and myth of the Prussian invincibility. That immediate and that familiar to every German. From then on, part of his very fundamental equipment. For the truth is that Prussia collapsed before Napoleon, that the king fled, and so did the empress whom in my youth we used to call Crying Louise, because we played around her monument, and she was always pictured as crying in her flight from Napoleon. But Napoleon himself stopped at the tomb of Frederick the Great to worship. And it is Prussia which then rose again. And eventually, as you know, Prussia became Germany, or Germany became Prussia in 1870. Now that I have sketched in detail, not in detail, God forbid, these three makers of Prussia, the question remains, why is all this important? Now, obviously, Prussia became an important power. And though, as I said, it will collapse in 1800, it will rise again in the 19th century. But there are three other reasons why it will be important, or is important, in the very way that it was constituted. First of all, it upset the balance of power of Europe. It created what we call a diplomatic revolution, namely the alliance of Austria and France, of the Habsburgs and the French king. You remember throughout all of this course, the Habsburgs and the French had fought each other ever since Charles the Great, Charles the Fifth. But now with the rise of Prussia, you have this revolution. And Austria allies itself to France, an alliance sealed by a famous marriage, by the marriage of Maria Theresa's daughter, Marie Antoinette. The most sentimental of you can now begin to cry. Marie Antoinette, the marriage of Marie Antoinette to the later Louis XVI. That marriage of Marie Antoinette to the Dauphin was to seal the diplomatic change, and it is the rise of Prussia which brought about this change. Secondly, because Prussia in 1870 became two-thirds of Germany, and the Prussian army became the German army, and the Junkers continued to dominate that army. The cadet schools were opened a little bit, but really hardly at all until 1918. Thirdly, the Prussian ideals tended to become German ideals, just as the Prussian Junker army became the German army, as I said, for all intents and purposes. How can we sum up these ideals, which were called Prussianism? First of all, the concept of the overriding duty of all social classes to the state. Classes are separate. Classes are distinct. But they all have one overriding purpose, and that is the purpose to serve the Prussian state. The middle classes by providing the money, the peasants and the nobility by providing the army. The working classes don't come into this. Secondly, they were also Prussianized, of course. They voted for Bismarck in overwhelming numbers. Those of you who are so taken with socialism might remind that. The working class districts in Berlin and otherwise voted for Bismarck in overwhelming numbers, and there is a certain Prussianization which also went into the working classes. Secondly, the concept of discipline combined with the concept of austerity. This is not an austerity as we know it today, governments clamping down austerity on countries which have lived over their means or lived well. This is an austerity that became an ideal from the 17th century on. The idea that Prussianism, that is to say nationalism, national allegiance, means austerity. That elegance means austerity. Look at Frederick the great hero's castle at Sanssouci. We were dragged to it constantly as little children. Austerity, austerity, austerity and discipline went together. These two things meant something else you might bear in mind. Why Prussia was such a bad, bad territory for National Socialism. Why National Socialism hardly ever got anywhere in Prussia. Because what all this excludes is irrational enthusiasm. What all that excludes is the irrational mass movement kind of thing. The Junkers were anti-Nazi, almost to a man. What that includes is mass movements. Indeed, what it excludes is democracy of this sort. And National Socialism was a democratic movement. So that this was unfertile soil for anything to do with a democratic movement, obviously. It was monarchical, austere, disciplined, and in that sense, rational, opposed to enthusiasms, to mass gatherings, to mass movements, and all of that. These were not respectable, if I can put it in this way. Thirdly, what you have here is the urge, and you must combine it, with eastward expansion. Prussia will look east. Why? Well, two reasons. First of all, it was the only place to expand. And of course, the division of Poland, which I talked to you about last time, that division of Poland helped. But there's a second reason. Agriculture is bad in Prussia. It's barren. The only thing you can grow is sugar beets. You can have enough sugar beets. It's barren. It's a landscape I love and admire, but it doesn't really produce anything. And so, when the Junkers wanted to have a more productive economy, they wanted to get more land. And the productive land is to the east. And therefore, the eastward expansion became an article of faith among the Prussian Junkers. The more land they could wrest from the east, from Poland, from Hungary, eventually in the Crimea, the more fruitful land they could add to their barren acres, the more they could have, as it were, a monopoly on feeding Germany. But as it was, their land was barren. So the peculiar agricultural problem of Prussia made Prussians look to the east, lent itself to eastward expansion, which will never fail, for the great tracts of land were in the east, which you could annex to your own unfertile acres. This is what is behind, then, thirdly, eastward expansion. And lastly, you have, of course, the matter of militarism, but not yet in a modern sense. Let us be clear about that. Militarism means, in this sense, merely that military considerations were always uppermost. But the idea of total war is not yet. When Frederick the Great conquered Silesia, he stopped. He didn't as yet go on and conquer all of Austria, which he could have done, which he could have done easily, would never have occurred to him. Territorial wars are limited wars. Wars for ideology are destructive wars. But we are not yet in the idea, in the time when you fight wars for ideology, to convert somebody to democracy, socialism, I don't know what, then that is a war of total destruction. We are still in the more civilized age of territorial wars, so that when you have a territory, you stop. You don't go on to unconditional surrender. Once you have ideology, you've got to do it, because you've got to convert all of these people. The only way you can convert people in that sense is to destroy them utterly, obviously. So that, I'm quite serious, this is what happened to make the world safe for democracy was the beginning of this rot. But we now have territorial wars, not ideological wars. And so you must not confuse militarism with the century of total war. That only comes with the First World War and after. Up to now, when we got the territory we want, we stop and make a peace treaty. And I must say, in retrospect, that seems singularly civilized. When Frederick got Silesia, he stopped and made a peace treaty. So all of these things go together. And all of these things have the meaning, then, of what we loosely call a Prussianism. The rise of these new nations, then, is one side of the 18th century. Prussianism is one side. And it means then, in a way, a total outlook, an attitude. But perhaps it is easier for you to remember if you remember it as a peculiar kind of nationalism. That is what it was, of course. A peculiar kind of nationalism. Expansionist, yes. Expansionist to the east of Europe. Expansionist to the Slavs. Expansionist, yes. But a peculiar kind of nationalism which will stress duty, austerity, and a well-defined class structure. A well-defined class structure. And it will, in a sense, and you always call it Calvinist, so I'd better say something about that. Sure, Frederick William I put Calvinism into his state church. His state church was a mixture between Lutheranism and Calvinism. I have told you that. But it was only partly Calvinism. It was partly the objective situation to make a go of this scattered territory. It was partly a singularly, you might say, incisive analysis of the objective Prussian situation. With this idea of duty and all this comes, of course, ideas of precision, ideas of punctuality. All these ideas which you associate only with middle-class virtue here become the virtue of a nation. Here become the virtue of a nation. And the Baroque is skipped. You do not see in Berlin much Baroque. This may have been startling to some of you. The Baroque is skipped, this extravagance, this exuberance, for, if you like, somber simplicity. The king in uniform, the king in uniform, the one-floor castle, somber simplicity, and a kind of despising of what in the rest of the world was the Baroque. Together with it, I must emphasize again that Prussia was the nation which harnessed the nobility. But then it had no Fronde in its past. It had no civil war in its past. Remember that. So that Frederick William I could bring it off to make a nobility of service, a nobility of service, and then institutionalize it through the army, through education. It's very typical, one last thing, that Frederick the Great, with all his enlightenment, gave over all the Prussian schools, or many of the Prussian schools, into the hand of the Jesuits, whom he despised as a man of the enlightenment. But again, it was a political decision. Jesuit schools had discipline. Jesuit schools had punctuality. Jesuit schools had all of these things which would make a man, in that definition, a better Prussian. Now we saw that both Prussian Frederick the Great and Catherine the Great thought of themselves as enlightened. I also told you that with both of them it was a veneer. But it is more than that, because both of them thought of themselves already not as divine right monarchs, but as first servants to the state. And as people think of themselves, so in a sense will they act. And part of the simplicity is an application of the Enlightenment, the king as first servant of the state. What we must consider next, then, is this Enlightenment itself, a change in human attitudes, which now comes to fruition. And this change of human attitudes, which you can imagine is due to many things. Once again, let's be careful not to have a one-causal explanation, your favorite one of classes and masses. Not a one-causal explanation. Let's have a multi-explanation. One thing that went into the Enlightenment undoubtedly is something that we have omitted and that we must catch up on. For part of the changed attitudes came with the rise of science and the application of science to philosophy. And though we must not exaggerate this, we must next time deal with this rise of science and with the change of attitude. But that again, of course, takes us back into the 17th century. For you must realize, all great changes are slowly come about slowly in history. There is in history no such thing as is Venus full-blown from her shell. That is a utopia. It does not exist. All changes are in preparation. And above all, changes in attitude do not come by, unfortunately, in my opinion, overnight. But changes in attitude also, it seems, have to be long prepared. And therefore, the change in attitude which leads to the Enlightenment was long prepared. And therefore, we have to go back to the 17th century and to the rise of science. This we will obviously do on Wednesday. Any questions?